Blog Talk Radio.
Guests heard on Voice of Barbados 92.9 FM. You can call us at 4341790. You can send us to WhatsApp at 2534679. Or an email at cricketmason@yahoo.com. Mason and guests is for the England side. It was a big victory as well, but you know what? The West Indies won the series 2-1. And I think that's really what we've got to focus on tonight, a West Indies victory. It is true that they were beaten badly, 232 runs. It's a comprehensive victory by the English side. And we're going to do an assessment, of course, of the third test and, of course, the series on Mason and guests this evening. The ODI squad has been announced, and that's of interest to us. We're going to be looking at that as well. And in terms of the regional cricket, yes, we can't forget our regional cricket. What a performance by Jonathan Carter. Now, I had a chance to see Mr. Jonathan Carter perform on the weekend. It was an innings of the highest order, 149, his best. In fact, the best I've ever seen him bat. And Barbados were able to win, in the end, comfortably against the Red Force side. But overall, they're not doing all that well. In fact, Barbados now in fourth position on 73. 0.6 points. Of course, the Jaguars haven't lost two matches. They're back in winner's row, but in terms of points, 112.4, and they should go on to win the championship quite comfortably for the fifth straight year. Also as well, speaking to Saquana Clinton, it's a bit of a sad story. This young Barbadian who would have captained the Barbados side and would have played for the West Indies, she's now in Canada, Dr. Ford, and she's been having some challenges. In fact, the fifth operation for the young lady, and she needs help. She needs help. And this evening, we're going to be talking to Hartley Reid about it in relation to what's been happening to her. She says to me she doesn't really want to come on air, but we're going to be speaking to Hartley Reid on it. It's a serious situation as far as this young lady is concerned, and I will tell you more. And of course, the spat between Ruth and our friend Gabriel. In fact, Mr. Gabriel is in some trouble. The ICC picked it up, and my golly, he is in trouble. In fact, he's been charged by the ICC, and we are going to be looking at that in a minute. But your opening comments, Dr. Ford, in relation to the loss by the West Indies today.
Yes, good evening, Andrew, and all the listeners. Well, you know, it wasn't one of our really good test matches. It's good that we've won the Wisden Trophy for the first time in many years. However, our batting, which has been our bugbear, let us down. And, you know, we gave up about 60 extras in this test match. Also, our catching was below par. And also, we lost the wicket because of a no-ball. So, all in all, the guys weren't as focused and as efficient as they were in the first two test matches. I guess Ralston Chase and the continued good progress of the bowlers are things that we can look at. But it's even though it is a bit disappointing. All in all, I think having won the first two test matches, I'm still quite pleased with how the guys have done. This is the best cadre of young West Indian test cricketers that we have, and it's really up to us and to the guys to develop themselves and to keep getting better at their craft.
Yes, well, good evening to you, Mr. Mason and Dr. Ford. Just want to say congratulations to the West Indies and all its supporters for a long-awaited victory. I was impressed in the first two games, not to that standard in the third test. I think we've been too complacent, especially in the second innings. I watched this morning. I've watched from 10 o'clock this morning at school. Of course, the constraints would have had me watching during class, Dr. Ford, but I would have seen some real complacency in the batting. I'm very disappointed with the top six. Ross and Chase showed some fight. I think if we are to surge to that number one place, which I heard Jason Holder talking about in the presentation, we need to improve our top six. You have two, our leading run scorers of the series in Jason Holder and Shane Dowich, our number 7 and 8 batsmen. And it has to improve. We've seen booming drives on a wicket where driving is very difficult. And some more discipline by Toby Radford needs to be instilled in the West Indies top order.
All right, let's go and make our first stop in Jamaica, the land of wood and water, and talk to Jackie Hendricks. I'm sure you remember that name, Ronnie Clark. Jackie Hendricks, in fact. Cigarfield Sobers, Red Excellent Cigarfield Sobers, actually said that he thought he was perhaps the best keeper in his time. And it's always good to talk to him. Jackie, good evening to you, sir. How are you?
Hi, Andrew. How are you, man? I'm okay. Not too bad, thanks.
Good, good, good. You must be happy about the West Indies win, 2-1.
Very, very, very happy. I'm really disappointed that we lost so handsomely in the third match, you know. I was looking forward to a sweep.
Indeed, that didn't happen at all. You believe had Jason Holder been there, it would have made a difference?
Well, you know, as I said to you the other day, I really have a great regard for Jason Holder and the way he is able to inspire his team. And it's very unfortunate that he wasn't able to play in this game.
Indeed.
I think that things might have been a lot different had he been able to take part.
Mm. What do you like about Jason Holder?
Well, first of all, I think he's highly intelligent, and I think that he has learned his job over the period that he has been in charge. I think he has done extremely well. He's learned it well, and I think West Indies cricket is far better off with him at the head, as he seems to be very inspiring, you know?
Yeah, I know. I know when he was initially made captain, you had some reservations.
Yes, I did. I just thought he was a bit young at the time to have been saddled with the responsibility of captaincy. But let me tell you, he has proved me totally wrong, and I congratulate him handsomely.
And in terms of the suspension, I mean, a lot of people have criticized the suspension of Jason Holder.
Well, he's not the first captain that has had to be suspended because of the slow over rate. I don't know. Andrew, I'm one of the old ones, and we used to get through overs pretty quickly. I mean, you know, 20 overs an hour.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking for 15 overs, plus all the deductions that that there are for the drinks breaks and the referrals to the third umpire. All of these things are taken out, and even the 2 minutes for the batsman coming in, you know.
Right.
So I don't think it is impossible to achieve 15, 16 overs at all. I just think it needs a little more care and, you know, making the effort.
Indeed. Well, Jackie, you would have been part of a winning West Indies side. You know, the team hasn't done well in the last, 15, 20 years. Why do you think, Jackie, that we've not been performing as well as we should?
I don't know. One of my things is that I wonder whether the different types of cricket that they're asked to play these days,
mm-hmm.
Has any bearing on the test match achievements of our team, because we have done pretty well, I think, in the shorter versions of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder whether we are not applying ourselves, not concentrating. Are we fit enough to go through 5 days of cricket? I don't know. I mean, remember in the days of the great West Indies team in the 70s, 80s, they were exceedingly fit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When Dennis Waite was the trainer, it stood them in good stead because, you know, if you're not fit and you're out in the middle for a little period of time, sometimes your concentration tends to lag. And I don't know. It's just a thought that I have that they sometimes are involved in all different kinds of cricket, and some of the shots I see them play in test matches brings me to that feeling that they're not discerning enough when they're playing the longer version of the game.
Hi, good night. Before the series, what were your expectations as far as the result of the series concerned, and also what aspects of the team's performance please you, and what other aspects concern you?
Well, first of all, I thought the series would have been a lot closer than it was. I did think that England had a pretty good team, and we were going to be hard-pressed to beat them. But I'm very impressed with our fast bowling. I think that there's between Broach and Gabriel and the other younger fellas, Joseph and so on, I think that that's a plus on our side. And I think that they had a great deal to do with the eventual outcome of the matches. You know, when you talk about softening up for the spinners, you know, I thought that was one of the pluses on our side. And plus, as you said, I think somebody said earlier on, Dorwich, I thought, performed admirably. Mm-hmm. Both behind the wicket and in the batting. And, of course, Holder, I thought, was a great inspiration.
Now talking about Dorwich, you were regarded by some as perhaps maybe the best keeper that we've had. I mean, that's a tremendous honour.
Too much of an honour.
what do you think of Dorwich as a keeper?
I thought he's quite good. I think his glove work is quite good. He is I think improving. I think he has improved over the last time I saw him. Mm-hmm. I think he has made a great improvement. Mm-hmm. His footwork is a lot better, and of course his glove work is he's had soft hands, which is always a plus, you know. And his anticipation. Seems to be very good.
What makes a good keeper?
Well, footwork, soft hands, and anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into position, getting your body behind the ball, and you know, being alert, very alert. You have to, even through the most dull parts of an innings, big keeper always has to be on the alert. So these are the things. Fitness is a very important mm-hmm. aspect of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Dorwich has been doing very, very, very well.
Indeed. And of course, in your day, you would have had, you know, Hall and Griffith, Prof Edwards and Lester King. And in terms of spin, you would have had Valentine and Gibbs. Tell us about that experience.
And don't forget Ramadan.
And Ramadan, of course. Yes, how could we forget Ramadan and Valentine?
Well, I must tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed keeping wicket to the spinners because, you know, something seemed to have been always something happening. And it was something that really kept you on the alert. But of course, Gilchrist, one mustn't forget Roy Gilchrist,
right,
who I consider to be the fastest bowler that I've ever kept wicket to. Not the most accurate, but as far as pace is concerned, although he did have a reputation that the old elbow wasn't too straight, you know.
Well, he was quick. But you were also saying to me that Lester King was one that could have played a bit more.
Oh, yes, I did think so. I thought that Lester could have played quite a bit more than he was allowed to, selection-wise. I thought, for instance, in Australia in 1968-69, I thought that he was probably our best pace bowler, best person with the new ball.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, he never really got an opportunity. Well, there's Hall and Griff were in front of him, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he didn't really get the opportunity that he I thought deserved.
Well, it's really good to go down memory lane with you, Jackie. You know, we certainly want to thank you for coming through and talking to us. But just before you go, in your time, who would have been the best batsman that you saw?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I have no hesitation. Sir Garfield Sobers.
Mm-hmm.
He was the best I thought I ever saw at Everton Weeks number two.
Okay, wonderful. What was so special about Sir Gary?
Everything. I can't pick any particular thing out.
Right,
but
right.
His timing, his reflexes, his eyesight. He was just superb. I mean, I've sat and watched so many innings of Gary that maybe I'm just biased. I don't know, but I thought he was the best thing I'd ever seen.
And
not only that, but I thought that Gary was one of the best fast bowlers that we ever had.
Mm. That's interesting.
He never bowled for long spells. Gary, most of the time, bowled very short spells and, you know, left it to the others to do the job. But I thought when he took the new ball, he was excellent, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He moved the ball around at will, you know, and he's very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember a test match at Old Trafford. No, sorry, at Trent Bridge.
Right.
When England were going into their second innings, and I think we led by about 300 or 250 or something. I don't remember the exact score. And on the way out to the middle, Gary said to Wes and Charlie, "I think I'll take the first. I'll take the first go at it."
Mm-hmm.
Boycott was the opener,
mm-hmm.
and within about three or four balls, he had hit Boycott with his finger on the pad, LBW, and he said, "Okay, fellas, you go ahead now, you know."
I just wanted to get Boycott out there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He was a tremendous, he was a wonderful cricketer. Some of the catches that Gary has taken, I mean, whenever I hear anybody comparing him to, mm-hmm. comparing somebody to him,
mm-hmm.
I cringe a bit. I don't see how it could be possible.
He was that great, yes.
He was, without doubt.
Tremendous. So what are you doing nowadays, though, Jackie? You know, you had a great time for the West Indies and, of course, for Jamaica. I know you were involved in a sports shop. Are you still active?
Yes, I had sports and games,
right.
And I sold that out quite a few years ago, and basically I'm retired.
You're retired, okay?
Yes, I was very involved with the cricket mm-hmm. up to about the middle of the 2000, and I think about 2008 I gave it up. And you know it's a void that hasn't been filled. I really miss it. But you know, you have to move on. Other people come in and take over, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I must say, Andrew, is that I'm very happy to hear you calling our team the West Indies.
Right.
I detest Windies totally.
Oh dear.
I've always known West Indies mm-hmm. cricket, and
that's an interesting one, Doctor.
Yeah. I wish we would.
He's not alone. Who mm-hmm. came up with the name? You know,
Windies. Yeah,
this is an easy marketing.
It sounds so. I mean, if I don't mind if I want to call the 2020 cricket Windies
right.
or whatever, but we're already the West Indies. That's where we made our name,
right,
as the West
right.
Indies.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I wish that we would go back to calling our team that.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Well, my final question to you, Jackie. Yeah. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. And to go down memory lane, we've not done well. I mean, this is true in the last 15, 20 years. What advice would you have for young West Indies cricketers going forward?
Well, I think practice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether our cricketers these days practice enough.
Mm-hmm.
Even at the club level, I don't know whether when they go to the nets, whether the bowlers bowl long spells, batsmen get a good long knock in the middle in the net. I don't know. I mean, I think that practice, as they say, makes perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I don't know whether our coaches have been as vigilant as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very, very disappointed to lose Bill Simmons. I thought he was going to make a hell of a difference to our team.
Mm-hmm.
It was unfortunate, and you know, but I do think practice is the thing. I think we have to spend hours in the nets.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can recall Jimmy Adams, who used to practice for hours, and I think I was told that one Christmas morning he went down to Savannah Park.
Oh, really?
And had a nap. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told this from long ago, years ago. And, you know, I think this is the type of dedication that one has to put into their game to perfect it, you know, because foot movements and so on, and the judgment, getting in line with the ball, all these things are important. And perhaps with somebody helping, can be the difference maker, you know.
Indeed. Well, Jackie Hendricks, I want to thank you very much indeed for coming through and talking to us. And enjoy the rest of your evening there in Kingston, Jamaica.
Okay, Andrew. Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Good. Jackie Hendricks.
All the best.
All the best. Right. Of course, he was a tremendous keeper. I mean, you know, when you talk about keepers, he didn't play for the West Indies for that long, but my God, he was a tremendous keeper and would have offered some good advice to the West Indies. Now, Doc, you've been doing an assessment of the West Indies. Where did you believe England went wrong?
Well, the England team didn't do very well in batting. I think that was what really let them down during the series. They seemed to be a bit surprised with the pace of Gabriel and the swing and seam of Butch, because in the three test series, only Stokes and Butler looked good at times. The captain came later and got a century in this dead rubber, and the pitch seemed to be kind of flat when he was batting, but maybe that's just how good a batsman he is. But certainly they didn't put up good scores. They didn't put up good partnerships, and I think the bowling really let them down. But as the series wore on, they got the construct of the team right. And I think, you know, they bought in Broad belatedly, and then you saw the sheer pace of Wood that really showed our vulnerability to extreme pace in this last series. But Moinali was really a revelation for me. Moinali took 14 of the wickets for them at 23 apiece, and he was the most successful of the bowlers, and really complimented the fast bowlers well. They caught quite well and they fielded well, but the batting let them down big time here, and I think it has to do with the construct of the team, having three wicketkeepers in the team at one stage, and you know, just having too many all rounders. So I think this compliment that they have for this last match with three specialist seamers and the all-rounder that can bowl spin decently proves to be a better compliment for them. And I'm sure they'll be looking at that for their next series.
Yes, well, you made it very clear, Doc. For me, it's team selection. I think had England maybe picked a Chris Watts, who was, I understand, not fit for the second test, or maybe even a Mark Wood, who was just, he said in the presentation, he simply just sat back and watched Shannon Gabriel bowl the entire series. And I think this series could have gone a lot different. You look at that pitch at Kensington Oval, where England got it terribly wrong with their spin. You add somebody like a Mark Wood to that mix, and it really shows. He clocked speeds faster than Gabriel up to 152 kilometers, and it just shows that, as you said, rightfully, our vulnerability to fast bowling, and it's a real concern for me looking at our top order. I think Chase was solid against Wood. He really showed and taught the batsman inside how to really play a pace, because we know Rawson Chase uses his height well. I just think he maybe needs to add a square of the wicket game to his archery, because I don't think he pulls and hooks very well, but that can come into development. But as you said, I think Mark Wood has really expressed something for Toby Radford that he needs to work on with the West Indies top order.
Now, do you believe, Doc, that we missed the holder? It would have made a difference?
Certainly. For me, you know, I'm really pleased with the work that Roach did. But for me, Holder was my man of the series. for a number of reasons. Holder ended up with the most runs for the series in only two matches. That's 229 runs. Granted, he had a big double century.
Yep.
But, I mean, in two matches, getting seven wickets. So, on averages, he would have got three more wickets and ended with about 10. He also took quite a few catches as well.
Excellent.
I think he took about four or five catches. But it's just the leadership and the way the guys respond to him, the respect. He was the guy who made the team, you know, be very efficient. He has a quiet way of marshalling the troops. And I believe that you saw the difference with Holder being the captain now compared to Brathwaite being the captain. I think there's a different dynamic. He has a brains trust, which involves communication with some of the other players. And I think he sets a better field. He's a bit more attacking, and I think that, you know, all in all, as a leader and on all sides of the ball, batting, bowling, fielding, excellent. So you can see the difference. You saw the results when we didn't have him in those few matches in Bangladesh, and now you see in a series where we're in the ascendancy and having a pitch that's just as good and having an all-rounder that bowls well, even though he can't bat as well as Holder. The batting really wasn't there. And this is a situation where when we're under the gun, and, you know, Holder would have come in and made some runs in one of those two innings and
could have saved us, yeah.
And helped out Dorridge and Chase and the others. So he's a big cog in our wheel, and, you know, I like the maturity and confidence. And, and then, you know, with the microphone, I think, you know,
right,
other than Brian Lara, we haven't had any modern-day captain that's as eloquent as he is.
Well, in fact, Jack Hendrick spoke to it earlier about being highly intelligent. Let's go to the Helen of the West and talk to Ernest Allaire. Hello, Ernest. How are you? Former CEO of Cricket West Indies. I think it was the West Indies Cricket Board. I think it was the West Indies Cricket Board then when you were CEO.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And hello to you, your guests, and all your listeners.
All right. Okay. You would have had a chance, of course, to watch the game, England winning over the West Indies. Where did the West Indies go wrong, in your view, Ernest?
I think a number of areas, if you still look at it. I think I just listened to one of your guests or speaking of the issue of leadership, and I thought the team looked rather flat from the very first ball that was bowled. You did not see the kind of intense, the kind of focus, the kind of determination that you had seen in the first two test matches.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been just a consequence of having won the first two. I mean, there's a tremendous psychological pressure on players to perform, and having crossed that line and achieved victory already in the series, you could have probably said more of a relief. But you didn't see that kind of professional intensity to really crush the opponents into the ground and win every single session and win the match. And they did not look as intense. I mean, I was not present at the first two matches, but I saw it on television. And I saw a team that was determined to perform. And you saw, you know, that they were performing. You did not feel it on this occasion. So there's a whole question of leadership, and of whether or not the intensity of the players, you know, having won the first two matches, was still there. You would have heard people probably suggest that the team should have batted first. But, I mean, when you bowl out a team for 277 in the first inning in a test match, you know, you really cannot question whether you should have batted first or second. I mean, you had every opportunity to bat and to put down a good score. And I must say, in the fourth innings, yes, we were going to chase 480-odd. But you really wonder what instructions were given to the players when they came out to bat. The whole approach seemed wrong. I mean, even if we were not going to score the 480-odd, but at least we would have gone as closely as possible and kept as much time as possible. And you really have to wonder what instructions were given to the batsmen. And you saw how Chase batted. Hadley made a false shot. But at the same time, you know, he scored a century. It would have been good for some of the younger players to take the opportunity to put a big score on the board. And if nothing else, improve the average. So there were a few areas you were very disappointed in. You really wanted to see some progress in the team in terms of one, the batting, and also to the attitudinal display on the field of play.
Now, Ernest, what about the suspension of a Holder? You thought it was harsh? I know the rule is there, but could that rule be tweaked? People think it's very harsh.
I mean, you know, the rules are the rules.
Right.
I think right now the ICC will have to look at the rule as it is now and to maybe give the match referee some leeway in terms of considering the context of the match before there is a rigid application of the rules. I mean, the rules are the rules. But, you know, if you do not give in your explanatory notes and your guidance to those applying the rules, the leeway, they will apply it strictly. But I think they should introduce a whole issue of context in the game. The principle must not be violated, which is that players should never slow down the over rate for the sake of slowing down play to try and gain an advantage. But you shouldn't do that. But I don't think West Indies did that on any of the two occasions. And therefore, any, you know, sensible match referee would have seen there was no attempt to slow down the game per se to get any advantage, which I think is what the rationale behind the rule changes were. And therefore, we would have to introduce, at least I hope West Indies Cricket Board, based on that experience, would argue for context to be considered when applying the rules, because, you know, if you had applied context, there would not be a rigid application of the rules, especially when on the second occasion there's a question of two overs. So I think that's for that should be for consideration by the
Mm-hmm. Now, Ernest, in terms of locals, St. Lucia's didn't turn out. Any particular reason? Is it the things are tough?
Things are tough, and things are tough just about everywhere you go. And I think persons will complain about the cost of the ticket. I must tell you, when I heard the cost of the ticket, I myself was shocked because they were kind of quite high. We've been spoiled by the low prices of T20 cricket matches, and we've certainly spoiled by the recent ICC Women's World Cup,
right,
where people turn out, you know, because the price is very attractive. And we've had, you know, a succession of T20 series where prices have been very reasonable.
Right.
And you wonder whether or not people were not, you know, in a sense, spoiled by those experiences. And they fought $100-odd a day for a test match, which is not the most glamorous of the cricket version.
So Ernest, are you saying that it costs a solution $100 a day to get into the ground? Is that what you're saying, at least?
Yeah, from what I was told, I mean, put
what?
It that way.
$100 a day?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Over 100 easy.
Oh, dear.
I never went to buy one because I have access to other ways of...
Of course, Ernest, you get complimentary tickets galore.
No, I was not necessarily complimentary, but I have friends who would still want to invite me to keep them company. But, I mean, I had family who went to buy. Of course, they were elderly, the
right.
elderly person, whatnot. But, I mean, you know, there was a complaint. And even though you had to pay $25 per day for packet
right.
in addition. So, I mean, it was not the cheapest thing to do. And certainly... people complain about that. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that test cricket is not the most glamorous cricket right now. We've been spoiled by succession of T20 tournaments with lower prices.
Mm-hmm.
And people were virtually shocked by the prices. And I mean, and even to pay for packing, I mean, this one really shocked me. And I virtually said, look, I mean, I can't accept that.
Really? You had to pay for parking as well?
Yeah, you had to pay for parking as well.
Really?
So it was quite. It was, you know, a little difficult for the average person. If you want to argue that, and there are those who will tell you, you know, buy tickets for 5 days, but of course you could have bought for 1 day, 2 days. But I think the popular. I'm saying what was the popular sentiment was that ticket price was too high. You know, but let's hope more people come out for the 1 days and the T20 and. I'm not sure what the price would be then, but it's a more glamorous version of cricket. So see what happens.
Yeah, so good evening, Mr. Eler. We have a situation here where a youngster like Shimron Hetmyer has just been handed a large contract from the Royal Challengers Bangalore. He can easily be sucked into the realms of franchise cricket. So if you are directing the Cricket West Indies, how would you advise them to go about this situation?
But I'll tell you something. I've been through the pains of this before when I was CEO, and you'd all recall the era of, you know, Narayan Pollard, and the pains that we went through. What made it worse for us was the players were encouraged to go down that road and to put themselves, in my view, before West Indies cricket, although they still maintain that they are committed to West Indies cricket. But, of course, they too decided to put their livelihood and their futures, of course, given the distrust of the board. I would hate to see West Indies cricket go back down that road, and it is why we need to have frank conversations with the players and the Players Association as to how to maintain the core of the cricketers to still be able to represent West Indies, certainly in Test cricket, but also allow them. And I think we had raised that issue with the ICC from very early. When the IPL started, we already had a future sports program, if you recall. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we were tied down to Test series during the time of the IPL. But we had made it very clear when the new future tours program would have been prepared, we did not want any matches that would slide clash with the IPL, just for us not to have to force players to choose between West Indies cricket, which at that time was the most, which still is the most lucrative T20 cricket. Now you have a proliferation of T20 leagues, and you have to be able to say to the players which ones you're going to allow them to play and which ones that you're going to basically require them, if there is a clash, to put West Indies first. And it has to be that kind of frank dialogue, and you have to hope that the players can be reasonable. You have to hope that the Players Association can use their moral suasion to assure the players that they will still, in, you know, safeguard their interest with West Indies cricket and to able to get the best out of them. And of course, you need to have the depth in your team mm-hmm. where you can, from time to time, have to have, you know, such a wide, you know, a wide collection of players to choose from, that if you face those challenges, you know how you can maneuver and to organize yourselves. So it's going to be difficult. I'd hate to see our new crop of young players, and we have some very talented young players and exciting young players coming up. And it looked like if we can just get, you know, all the little elements kicking, we can have a very strong Test and One Day team and T20 team that we will face these same old challenges. I would have hoped that we all can learn from it, the board, the Players Association, the players themselves, that the best way forward is for all of us to compromise and to work together. It's not easy. It's easy to say. And being somebody who is at the center of it, I can tell you, it offers the administrators some real sleepless nights and a lot of gray hair trying to solve those problems.
Okay. What is your personal opinion as it relates to the structure of Cricket West Indies mm-hmm. needing to be changed, which is something which was mm-hmm. suggested by some cricket lovers?
Well, I mean, I've always been one who advocated for changes. I mean, I said so before I became CEO. Whilst I was CEO, I advocated for changes. I have never gone as far as some of the advocates who've argued for cricket commission to be placed above the board. I don't think that's necessary. In fact, mm-hmm. I think it's a bit insulting to suggest that the directors that are chosen are not wise enough to have a board over the head of wise men that decide the best for this cricket. I don't believe in that. But I do believe, though, that we need to make the board have more independent directors, people who you believe would not put the territorial interests above the corporate interests. And I think you need to reduce the number of territorial board representatives on the board and allow more independent representatives to be on the board. You should not entirely give up the territorial board representatives, but I think it is too heavily weighed in that direction. And there has to be, you know, pendant decision-making, because I know from experience, and you understand why they do it. They come as representatives and not as directors. They do look for the best interest of the territorial board. And, you know, you have to find a way to overcome that, to always make sure that the corporate interest is there and is always at the forefront.
Well, of course, that's a very good question you asked, Doctor, because I know that behind the scenes, there's this talk about an executive president. We also have the elections coming up very soon on, what was it, March the 24th. I note with interest that Dave Cameron just wrote to the Jamaica Cricket Association. I believe you've seen a clip of that on Sportsmax, and he's asking for their support. And from my understanding is that he's going to be nominated by the Windwards and Guyana. So the elections are going to be very, very interesting in another month or two. Ernest, I'm sure you're paying some attention to that.
Well, I mean, I have been hearing a lot of stuff. I don't think we need to have an executive president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't see the need for that. I believe in the professionalization of the organization. And as one who has served as CEO, I think you need to have a very professional staff in place, people who can deliver and perform and to be held accountable by a board. I also believe that the president represents the board,
mm-hmm.
and the president and the CEO must have an excellent working relationship. So Julian and I had an excellent relationship,
right.
And we worked very well together. And I had to report to him, and I spoke to him many times a day on what I was doing and making sure that he was. And we were during a very intense period. When I was CEO, you recall before I became CEO, there was a strike every year for about 4 or 5 years. And in a sense, we had to stop the cycle of, and there was strikes in Westminster cricket, and we had a lot of big issues, the MOU, CDA to deal with, and the number of mediations to deal with. And it was a very intensive period. I couldn't report it to the president almost on a daily basis, and he then spoke to his directors
mm-hmm.
as to what was happening, and then he would advise me what the sentiments of the directors were. So I believe the CEO and the president should have an excellent relationship. I don't think you should have a situation where the CEO and the president in an antagonistic relationship because it won't augur well. At the same time, I don't think the president should be directing the work of the secretariat. That should be left to professional staff. You take policy decisions and you pass it on to a CEO to supervise the implementation. You get regular reports for him how it's been implemented. And you expect the president to report to his directors and what's going on, what's not going on. And if directors have issues, they will speak to their president who will obtain feedback from you. If you have directors who are chairpersons of committees and as CEO you have to relate to them, you do so. But you do not necessarily, you don't allow directors or the president to be involved
mm-hmm.
in the implementation of the decisions of the board and the strategic direction outlined by the board.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the professional staff to do, and you should get the best staff to be able to do that for you. And that's how it has to be. I think once you start having an executive presidency, then you're starting to look for problems,
mm-hmm.
you know. It reduces accountability, it reduces oversight, it reduces, you know, just the share, you know, capacity of the staff to do their work properly. And it almost begs the question, do you really need the professional staff if you can have, you know, executive directors and executive presidents to run the affairs of the board? I don't think that is very good.
Well, Ernest, I can tell you two weeks ago, there was a meeting in Trinidad, the governance committee, and that was discussed, the whole question of an executive president. And from my understanding, it's looking pretty good. So I think you've got some more work to do, Ernest, in that regard.
Well, I mean, I'm expressing my personal view. I mean, I've not spoken to anybody
right.
About that. So, see, I've heard about it.
Yes.
But I don't think that should be encouraged. I mean, if the president has an issue with the CEO
right.
and he feels he should have more say in the day-to-day functioning of the board, I would suggest to him that he changes the CEO
mm-hmm.
and he get a CEO that he can work with,
mm-hmm.
that he can give instructions to and that he can discuss issues and they can argue. I mean, Julian and I had a very good working relationship. It didn't mean we agreed on anything, but we argued, we debated
right.
issues, and
yeah.
then at the end of the day, I was allowed to implement it. And I don't think directors would tell you whether there was a line between Dr. Julian Hans and myself.
Mm-hmm.
We operated in a kind of seamless fashion. But we had a kind of working relationship where in private and in our dialogues, we can disagree and argue and debate issues.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was given instructions to do things a particular way,
mm-hmm.
unless it was so morally reprehensible or so totally unacceptable, I would follow it because he is the one responsible for the vision and the delivery of the strategic direction of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And if I felt it was I couldn't deliver it, I had to leave the job. You know, that kind of approach is what you take. So if the president believes the CEO is not listening to him and he has to get more involved to ensure that the strategic direction outlined by the board to be implemented, then he should change the CEO and find somebody he can work with.
Well, Ernest,
that would be my advice.
I want to thank you for coming through and talking to us. We hope to talk very soon again. Thanks for your contribution on Mason and Guest.
Yeah. Thank you very much, as usual. Continue the good work.
All right. Thanks to you. Ernest Hilaire, the former CEO. We're going to pause for business calls. When we come back, we hope to find Mark Rampakash, who must be smiling. Mason and Guest is brought to the association with our very good friends at Barbados Stottery for more than new sport and culture.
Our nation has produced some of the greatest cricketers to ever play the game. We're proud of our Bajan sons and daughters who've stamped their names in cricket history. Support this proud heritage of over 125 years of Barbados cricket. Play the $3 instant scratch game, Cricket Celebration, from the Barbados Lottery with a top prize of $20,000 cash and over $400,000 worth in prizes waiting to be won. Part of the proceeds of every ticket goes to the Barbados Cricket Association, available at Barbados Lottery agents islandwide.
All right, let's go across to the Executive President, Dr. Ford. You got the job, Doctor?
I'm not aware.
indeed. Well, we're going to try and talk to Mark Rampakash now. What do you think he's going to say?
Well, he certainly should be more upbeat than our previous two conversations, and also the pressure from our English guest would not be here. So,
freely. Mr. Mason, if I may. Just getting a question to me. It says, who would be the panel's choice for vice-captain in next test series? It's because everyone just seems to think that the team looks flat under Craig, so they want to know who are the viable alternatives.
No, that's the question to you.
Oh, Mr. Mason, are you running?
No. As a leader yourself.
Yeah, in a situation where you have the captain, the vice-captain is a job which has no execution. If Craig is someone who thought he'd be captain material but needs some work and practice, then that's something we should endeavor to do. But evidently, it's clear that the weight of being captain has affected his batting even more than
he averages 15 when he's captain. Yeah.
Yep, indeed.
So he was looking, he was scratchy and trying his best during the series and just barely missed a couple of 50s, but seemed to be a bit under the pump this time. But you know, he's a young guy and he's a fighter, and you know, he has a lot of time between now and India to try to work on any aspect. You think?
Well, Doc, let's go to a smiling Mark Rampakash. Hello to you. How are you, my friend? Your smile must be as broad as St. Lucia.
It absolutely is. Yeah, good evening. Yeah, it's nice to be on your show and have something nice, good to talk about.
Indeed,
it's been a long three.
Yes, indeed, a good win, huh? Good, very good win.
Yeah, it was actually. I mean, I spoke to Otis Gibson before the game. He said it would be a very good cricket wicket, and it was. And, you know, there was a bit in there for the fast bowlers when they bent their back. But if you were selective in your shots, you know, if you backed your defense and, you know, the bad ball came along, you could put it away because the ball came onto the bat. So it was a really good cricket pitch. And, of course, I think probably the game turned when Moeen Ali and Mark Wood sort of combined in partnership we actually saw a West Indian batting collapse, not an English batting collapse.
Yeah, indeed, we saw that, yes.
So that
one
was
for all out, yes.
And you know, that period really swung the game, and you know, we had a first innings lead, and we know that in Test cricket, if you have a first innings lead, you know, it really piles on the pressure.
Indeed. Now, you talked about the pitch. Would you say of the three, Barbados, Antigua, St. Lucia, would have been the best?
I think the first and the third test, Barbados and St. Lucia, were excellent cricket pitches. You know, they produce an entertaining product. You know, that's what we want to see. We want to see a good attacking cricket, a pitches with a bit of pace and bounce, a bit of movement. We know that the balls that, you know, you're using in the Caribbean now, you know, they got a bit more swing and they last a bit better, so the seamers can operate. You know, I think Roach Kumar was outstanding, and he apparently has attained more swing this series than he has in the past. And I think he used it brilliantly. So, you know, I think we saw entertaining cricket, you know, and that's what, you know, test cricket needs to be.
Well, he got 18 wickets in the three test matches and bowled well. And as far as you're concerned, we would have had your bowling. Ali was at the top of the stack with 14. And tell us about Mark Wood. When you look at the overall selection of the teams, of course, for Barbados, for Antigua and St. Lucia, on reflection, you felt England got it wrong in some instances in terms of team selection?
Yeah, look, I think it's fair to say in hindsight that I think England perhaps came over here expecting pitches that we saw 4 years ago, which were pretty flat, very dry, quite slow, and in the end turned. Certainly when England lost in Barbados, you know, that was how the pitch behaved. And the other two were fairly benign, placid surfaces. So the tour party was probably selected with that in mind. And Mark Wood was not part of the original squad. Now, Mark has been around for a while. He has played test matches. He's been in and out of the team, mainly not because of form, but because of injury problems with his ankle. He's had a persistent ankle problem. And so he's found it very hard to sustain a period of being fit for the longer format of test cricket. But it was wonderful. He's a very popular guy. It was wonderful to see him steam in like that. It was hostile stuff. And, of course, we know that when you have that sort of pace in test cricket, you know, things happen.
And perhaps you might have given some consideration to him maybe for the second test?
Well, of course, yes, but of course he had only just arrived.
Right, so okay.
It's not really advisable to sort of bring someone over on a plane journey and sort of throw them straight in. You've got to be a little careful with that. But he was in the shake-up, I think. Of course, we saw Stuart Broad come back into the team anyway. So, yes, I mean, look, getting that balance of the team right for England was crucial. And, you know, we've seen us in Sri Lanka, England played three spinners and ended up with Johnny Bairstow at number three. He got 100. We had Ben Folks who came in as wicketkeeper. He got 100. We came to the Caribbean, perhaps... we didn't really see the surfaces that we thought we might. And so that the balance of the side with hindsight, you know, we probably would change if we had the option.
No, you lost to one. When you do an overall assessment, Mark, where did England go wrong?
Well, it's undoubtedly the batting, no question about it. I think, you know, the terrific spell that Kemal Roach bowled in Barbados.
Right.
We were shot out for 77. You know, it kind of shocked the guys, really. And I think, you know, Jason Holder and Darwich had a superb partnership. And, you know, we then really faced an uphill task. And in the second innings, you know, what do? You're trying to bat out a game, but there's so much time and people don't play their natural way of playing. So suddenly we were really on the back foot. And I think West Indies gained a lot of confidence from the way they played in Barbados. Their bowlers bowled very well in partnership. And, you know, their players were very disciplined. And it took us a while to adapt our approach. And I think for the third test, we saw a better balance in terms of the way the batsmen approached it. So they had a bit more of a probably an orthodox process of trying to establish a base at the top with, you know, the openers trying to bat a bit of time, leave the ball well, and then, you know, hopefully throughout the order, the lower order, the middle order would benefit from the hard work up top. And I think we got a better balance in the third match.
Indeed. What's next for Mark Rampakash? I know that Graham Thorpe is coming. The ODI start in Barbados next week. Are you going to stay in the Caribbean?
I'm very lucky. I've got 7 days here. My parents and my two daughters are coming over, so I'm going to enjoy a few days in St. Lucia, away from the UK winter. And then, you know, just back to the UK and sort of keep in touch with the cricket world. But there's nothing sort of definite on my radar right now.
Two things before you go. We saw the suspension of Jason Holder and then the charge of Shannon Gabriel. What's going on there? What's your reaction?
Well, it's very unfortunate. I think it's very unfortunate. Shannon has bowled terrifically well, I tell you. He's looked fit. He's bowled with a lot of pride and a lot of passion. I think he was terrific in this match. I mean, let's not forget, you know, West Indies were 2-0 up. And yet still, Shannon bowled 25 overs in the first innings. He came back again, bowled more than 20 overs in the second innings when West Indies were a bowler down. So, it's very unfortunate. I hope people remember Shannon's efforts, you know, and how well he's bowled and not sort of this unfortunate incident.
Well, he's been charged. Did it catch the English team surprise based on what he's alleged to have said?
Look, you know, I don't think the England team really have had too much to say about it, you know, to be honest with you. You know, well, look, I think anyone who's played cricket know that fast bowlers, you know, it's hard work, it's a physical effort, and you know, when you're a batsman, you're used to some bowlers losing their temper. I have to say that I can think of at least two Australian bowlers who would have been banned for a very long time in terms of what they said to me on a cricket pitch. So, you know, you kind of know that these things happen. It's a passionate game. You know, you're playing, the stakes are high. Shannon comes across as a very nice guy, and, you know, the England team really haven't given it too much thought.
Hi, Mark. The England openers haven't done well for the entire series or the number three. And, you know, the West Indians, well, we got about 450-run partnerships, even though we do have our problems. How do you – what are your comments on the techniques of the openers on both sides and their relative lack of success?
You know, I think it's a good question, and I think that I don't think that this is just a problem that England have. Honestly, we saw India come to the UK in the summer with very well-established international batsmen, and they really found it difficult. So Murali Vijay got a pair at Lords. He's got a lot of international runs. You know, Shikhar Dhawan didn't get many runs in the series. These are guys with big reputations. Pujara even wasn't selected for the first game because he looked so out of form. So, you know, I think what's happening in world cricket is that we are seeing less players wanting to play the long game, to back their defence, to do the hard work, hard yards against the new ball and build an innings. And there are lots of pitches that are quite bowler friendly. You know, we saw some pitches in South Africa recently that were very bowler friendly, and it's hard work. So look, you know, our job is to try and work as hard as we can with them and help them to bridge the gap between the domestic cricket and the test cricket. And it's not easy in the glare of the spotlight to do that. So, look, I think it's a problem that England will think long and hard about. I think before the Ashes, you know, there's a lot of domestic cricket. Keaton Jennings and Roy Burns and Joe Denley, you know, hopefully they'll get some good scores under their belt in the domestic game and push their claims. But we also need competition for places, and we need other players to push and get big scores. But the fact is that there aren't the people scoring the volume of runs that there used to be. And I think that when we're judging the top order now, we may have to adjust our expectations in terms of, you know, what their averages might be.
Final question to you. They hold the suspension. You thought it was harsh. And if you had to make any recommendations to the ICC in relation to that rule, what would you say to them?
Well, my view on this was, I'm not sure that it's the right way to handle the issue.
Right.
However, the ICC have been under huge pressure to try and address the issue of overrates, and so they came up with this way of doing it. Both teams knew, you know, the consequences. I think that needs to be recognized. But as a cricket fan, you want to see the best players playing the game, unquestionably. And the loss of Jason was a huge factor in this last match. So it's very unfortunate for him. I don't know. The West Indies will have to think about their approach and how they and how they go about upping their over rate. But certainly the ICC have got plenty to think about in terms of whether they want the best players, you know, missing matches because of this reason.
All right. Thanks to you, Mark, for coming through. And we really want to thank you very much indeed. The last 3 weeks or so you've been with us on Mason and the Guest, and we thank you very much indeed for that.
Thank you very much indeed.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. All right. Time is slipping by. Let's go to Trinidad and Tobago and talk to the noted journalist Fazer Mohammed. Hello, Fazer. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all, Andrew.
Good. Now talk to me. 2-1. Did you expect this?
No, I didn't. As I said before, I put it on the record. I expected England to win either 2-0 or 2-1. So I can disingenuously claim that 2-1 was right. But I was very wrong because I picked that it would be England who would win 2-1. And I think even with the defeat by 232 runs and the fact that England got a measure of consolation, I think this is a fantastic performance by the West Indies to reclaim the Wisden Trophy.
Where did England go wrong in your view, Fazer?
a number of ways. They started poorly by leaving out Stuart Broad, bringing in Sam Curran. Mm-hmm. And as you've been discussing with other guests, the problems with their top order, with their batting order, their preparation. I think it just marked up a level of arrogance, which they obviously will not acknowledge. It was sort of a halfway, half-baked sort of preparation, which seemed to suggest, well, they felt that they'd just come out of Sri Lanka 3-0. Wouldn't be all that different again against the West Indies, who have noticed the cannon fodder against other opposition over the last few months. And I just think that by the time they were really attuned to the challenge ahead of them, they were behind the eight ball, but that takes nothing away from what the West Indies would have done. And I think, to be quite honest, Andrew, I think there's been far too much focus, even from a Caribbean point of view. We're always preoccupied with what Jeff Boycott says, with what Michael Vaughan says, with what whoever says about the England team or what they are saying about our team. I think it's about time that we have our own voices and our own personalities, of whom we have some of the finest in the world who have played the game, to talk more about West Indies cricket than being preoccupied with what other people do.
Where did the West Indies go right, Fazer?
The West Indies went right from the very outset with the pitches, by preparing pitches, much like we saw against Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. There's always the fear that it could backfire. It did to a degree in the third test match with Mark Wood taking those five wickets in the first innings. But certainly when you've got an opportunity, Andrew, to give four fast bowlers a pitch that hurts them, that certainly makes a huge difference. That, to me, is the most significant element as to the dividing line. Just think about it, Andrew. If you had Jerome Taylor, Fidel Edwards, Keno Best, and anyone else you could come up with bowling on similar surfaces, I think they would have similar type results. And clearly, there was a deliberate intent by the authorities over the past two decades to have flat, lifeless pitches simply because we didn't have confidence in our own cricketers.
Indeed. Okay, let's go up to Jamaica and we're going to have Wayne Lewis join you. Hello, Wayne, how are you?
Hi, Andrew. It's been a while. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
All right. Good indeed. All right.
I saw your guys.
Of course, I saw you on Sports Max yesterday with Lance Whittaker. I'm talking about some rather interesting stuff. But we're celebrating the West Indies victory. Fazer Mohammed, your good friend from Trinidad, is on the line. You must be quite a happy man there in Jamaica with the West Indies victory over England 2-1.
I am, and hello to fans. I mean, you're wearing, I could say, what word am I using? I want to say unfamiliar territory. That's the word.
Right, indeed.
We're doing a dead rubber with us in front winning the series. We're not accustomed to that. So it was a celebration, really. We haven't had this type of, you know, success in quite some while. And it was really happy and heartening to see, you know, us going 2-0 in the series and shocking the Englishmen. And I'm quite pleased.
Indeed. What's the reaction to the West Indies victory in Jamaica? Must be quite positive, like the rest of the Caribbean.
Overwhelming, to be honest with you. People are just very joyful. And of course, you have the critics today, you know, that West Indies came down and the bubble has been blown somewhat. Persons starting to critique and people are pointing fingers left, right and centre. As if they had expected us to be 2-1 in the series. You know, and we had offered 2-1 in the series before it started, we would have taken it with both hands and feet and feet and everything. We would have taken it. So 2-1 and we lost the third test, you know, after losing our captain and so on. I thought that it was unfortunate. I made some of the comments, but nevertheless, I am staying in the moment and I'm quite pleased and quite happy with West Indies winning the series. We needed it.
Let's go to Fazer now. Fazer, they, first of all, Holder not being there, you think that would have made a big difference?
Probably would have made a big difference because you look at his performances throughout the series, not just with bat and ball, but as a leader. And we've been severely critical of him over the years and his tactics and his defensive mindset. But you have to give credit where credit is due. He's been able to mold a unified team, mold a strong team, a competitive team, certainly in the shape of this series. And therefore, he would have been missed in that sense. But as he himself acknowledged, both at the time that the penalty was handed down to him in Antigua and speaking on television commentary a couple of days ago, he said, look, England have four fast bowlers as well. They don't have a problem with their over eight. That's something we need to sort out. The rules are the rules. And once those rules remain, we need to sort our own issues out. So he wasn't casting blame on anybody other than himself and his team.
Well, of course, people have been saying, Fazer, that no, the test match finished, you know, in what, 3 days. That doesn't make a difference, does it?
It does. It makes a difference in the sense that, once again, as was mentioned by your guest a short while,
right,
we often overlook the fact that broadcasters run the game.
Right.
Not the ICC, not Cricket West Indies, not anybody else. Broadcasters run the game because they are the ones who send the billions of dollars in television rights to the ICC
right.
and other organizations. It happens the same in football. We've had these situations before in World Cup football where big players missed semifinals and finals
right.
because they got two yellow cards. And many people have argued, how could you do that? You're taking away from the glamour of the big occasion. Well, the fact of the matter is, you can't have a situation where you've got nasty tackles in football, and you can't have a situation where players and teams continuously take too long to bowl their overs, even if it finishes inside mm-hmm. 2 days. And I understand the point that people are making, but the ruling is over rate, mm-hmm. and that's rate per hour. So there's no allowance based on my understanding of whether it finishes in 3 days or 4 days. If we want to go that way, Andrew, mm-hmm. when do we draw the line? Because by definition, mm-hmm. if you've won a test match, mm-hmm. it means that you've won it inside the time.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it means no team should be ever penalized
right.
for a slow over rate if they've won the test match.
Can I comment?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
I personally think that in football, and since, Fazio went there, if you play in the World Cup at a certain time in the World Cup, then the yellow cards are suspended, are wiped out, and you start again, and you go into the knockout
yep. phase.
So mm-hmm. there are things like that. I think they need to have some addendum within the rules where for 2 overs, for the West Indies to go over by 2 overs,
right.
and you find that the captain has been suspended. I think they should have it like, you know, if you're over by X amount of overs,
mm-hmm.
as a 5 or 10 overs, or 6 overs, whatever, then you look to where you might be suspended. But for the West Indies team to be over by just only 2 overs, that's kind of harsh to find that the captain, yes, even though your infringements in within the last year. But to say you're over by 2 overs and you cost him a test match and really set up the West Indies now where they ended up losing the test series,
mm-hmm.
test match, mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to accept. I mean, the rules are the rules and what's out there. But you need to have some kind of other stuff that can facilitate and prevent a player, the captain, from being suspended in the middle of a series.
No. Fazil, let's turn to your good friend, Sean Gabriel, charged by the ICC for a apparent homophobic remark. Are you surprised by all of this?
It's interesting how this has developed, because clearly there was something that was said that prompted Joe Root to make a remark referencing homosexuality is nothing to be ashamed of or anything
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, what has Shannon Gabriel been charged with?
Right.
Unless Joe Root comes forward and testifies as to what Gabriel said, because he was asked about it by the media
right.
Yesterday, and he said he's not going to go there, he doesn't want to talk about it, but he was the one who made the remark. And now, of course, we have a culture in the Caribbean, whether we want to accept it or not, or whether we choose to pretend it doesn't exist, where there's a celebration of homophobic lyrics in some elements of our culture.
Right.
It happens right here in Trinidad and Tobago. It's become a big issue during one of the elements of the carnival season that we're counting down to. And in other parts of the Caribbean, it's also an issue about remarks made, derogatory remarks, violent remarks made towards those in the LGBTQI community.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the reality.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is for me in this situation is, on what evidence is Shannon Gabriel to be charged if it wasn't picked up by the stump microphone,
right.
if it wasn't heard by the umpires, if it wasn't obviously heard by the match referee,
mm-hmm.
is he going to be charged on the basis of circumstantial evidence? And one of the issues that I've always had with the international arbitration of the game is that there almost always seems to be an ease
mm-hmm.
to punish so-called lesser nations, which include the West Indies, when the other nations, and I've seen clear evidence of it before, the likes of England, Australia, and now India, because of the power that they wield in the game,
mm-hmm.
they generally get away scot-free.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, do you want to respond?
Well, I'm sure that the players would have been told what not to say on the field. I mean, no homophobic stuff, no racial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to embarrass anyone. We in the Caribbean are very loose when it comes to things like that. I agree with Tazi totally.
Mm-hmm.
And we will say things openly without even thinking about it, homophobic stuff, and it's the norm within our region.
Mm-hmm.
But in those countries, they take it very seriously.
No, very seriously indeed, yeah.
About not to say stuff like that, you know, not to say anything derogatory. Even if somebody is gay, you're not to put them down in any way, and therefore, you just need to be careful. Yes, I know that pinch and run high on the field and emotions and people that feel tough and play hard cricket. And, you know, the emotions sometimes are better of playing. They'll say stuff. But they need to understand that it comes with consequences. And if it is clearly stated that things like this ought not to be said, then you just don't say it. You try and find another way to get your point across or your frustration rather than saying something like this and bringing the game into disrepute. You don't want to get into stuff like that.
Indeed. Well, before you go, Wayne, I saw you in Sportsmax. In fact, I'm making the rounds, of course. In fact, somebody sent me a WhatsApp message. And your whole approach in relation to a letter that was, in fact, sent by Dave Cameron and his vice president seeking support from the Jamaica Cricket Association. And you were talking to Lance Vidica on Sportsmax, and you were quite surprised that the Jamaica Cricket Association may not support Cameron. Could you expand on that?
Well, I have heard stuff around that this might be the direction in which members within the JFA hierarchy might be going. So it's just a rumor. There's no confirmed position. I think I just heard things, you know, people say things, they call it rumors, some people call it tumors. Don't know. But it is said, it has been whispered around that Dave Cameron will not be supported by the Jamaica Cricket Association. And I was just simply saying I don't understand why. Dave has always struggled to get support from the JCA. When I was on the board, it created, you know, almost a debacle, really, when the JCA voted 9-6 to support Joel Garner, who didn't even ask Jamaica for his support. Right. For their support, and you know, I was a part of that, and it created some problems. It went to the AGM and it was overturned. That decision was overturned by the full body.
Right.
And the JCA was instructed to support the Dave Cameron, and I think the vote went 67-22 in favor of Dave.
Right.
Now it starts all over again now, and it is being rumored again, as I said, that they are looking not to support him. So I would just ask the question and answer accordingly. But I don't understand either. Based on, you know, the achievements of Dave Cameron, what he has been able to accomplish in terms of, you know, player retention, you know, insurance situation now, the settling down of Weeper and the West Indies cricket. And there's some good things happening for that. There's been spending a lot of this money on litigation matters and so on. But those monies can be spent on cricket development. So I thought that he has achieved a lot, and that Weeper is taking a position. We are in the Midland. Dave Cameron should be challenged, and he lost. Then we'll have to deal with the new administration going forward. So we are not in a position where we're trying to make a selection as to who we want to support. You know, we're not going to get into whoever is victorious at the polls. Then we'll have to look to forge a relationship with them. But I would just ask the question as it relates to Jamaica and its relationship with Dave Cameron.
Faz, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, a couple of things. I don't think it's incumbent upon the GCA to support someone just because they happen to be Jamaican, because that takes us back to the insular perspective, which we have always tried to escape, but we just can't seem to escape in cricket in the Caribbean. Because, for example, if there were a Trinidad and Tobago nominee that goes forward, I don't think it should be automatic that the Trinidad and Tobago Cricket Board supports that individual because he or she is Trinidadian. It would have to be that whatever policies, whatever perspective that they bring, if they've got a track record, that you judge on the basis of that. Because if you're going to go that way, we're going to take us back to the dark old days when we traveled around the territories and the captain would be from the different territories. And that certainly is not something we want to entertain. But I'm actually surprised that this is an issue at all, because I'm convinced that Dave Cameron is going to win this thing hands down. Because there's so much money flowing into West Indies cricket this year with the England tour, with the World Cup, with India coming, and great now with the West Indies, with the added fillip of winning the series against England, lifting the Wisden Trophy. What better time than for Dave Cameron to be re-elected president of Cricket West Indies?
Wayne, do you want to respond to that? Or do you think Dave is nervous?
Well, it's an election. I mean, you know, I've learned. I was part of the JC when we challenged Billy Heaven the leadership of cricket in Jamaica. And we were quite confident that we would have won. We were assured, basically.
Right.
You never know when one goes there and, you know, that window. So therefore, I'm sure you must be concerned. I mean, I've not had any discussions with Dave as it relates to his mindset going into the elections, but there hasn't been anyone nominated to challenge him. There's just rumors at the moment. So therefore, I'm sure within himself, he might have in his position that I'd be cautiously optimistic. But you never know. And because of the relationship that he has had with a number of cricket personnel within the region, including prime ministers and so on, that he must be very concerned about his position going forward, and he no doubt will be relying on his achievement in putting West Indies cricket forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, to move to a less controversial topic.
I just want to say one thing, Matt. And I understand what Faz is saying as it relates to, you know, you shouldn't be supporting one because he's a Jamaican and he's a Trinidadian. But for some reason, it tends not to work like that in my, you know, experience in the West Indies. I mean, you know, insularity is very much still in West Indies cricket, even though some of us try to hope and talk as if it's not there. It is there. Hard to know. And every country, you could say individually, has their problems as it relates to stuff like that. Talk about Australia. Patrick Patterson once told me that if you play for Tasmania, yeah, Tasmania is the most difficult thing is to get into an Australian setup. Yeah, issues between England with Yorkshire men and so on. Yorkshire is strong, England is strong. And so the country, you could say individually, has their problem as it relates to insular attitude and approach. So, yes, we'd like to see that out of West Indies cricket, but I have no doubt when it comes to situations like an election and persons want to be a favourite, that you will have some level of insularity there.
Okay, a less controversial topic. Just to ask both of you briefly, how do you think John Campbell has fit into the team as a new opener in just his first three tests?
Let's start with Fazir.
Okay, I think he did an excellent job. I think he played way beyond his numbers because going into it, he had a first-class average of 30. He featured in three successive, which we haven't had that sort of consistency for a long time. But the manner in which he felt today would just remind everybody that he tends to be a bit too loose, as with many left-handers outside the off-stump. To his credit, he's a positive type of player. But I just remember that time when he tried the Dill scoop.
Yes,
got hit in the helmet. Yep.
In the second test match. I mean, that's the sort of shot that will tell you he still is clearly far too much influenced by the T20 format of the game. But I have to give credit to him because I didn't expect him to get too much based on his numbers coming into the series. He played his part in a winning West Indies campaign. But moving forward, you'd want to see someone like a John Campbell really build on this and not just get 50s and 40s and get out or give it away, but go on to get the big 100 if you really want to talk about establishing a proper test match opening pair.
Wayne? John Campbell?
We and myself had a discussion with him the week before it was announced that he was in the West Indies team. And, you know, I made mention and talked to him about he has been around West Indies cricket for quite some time. And I said to him, I remember, by the time he gets to 27 years old, if you're not into the West Indies team, they're no longer mentioning you as a youngster. They're going to be saying that you've gotten your chance and they've been looking for other players to come through. So you need to do it now. I think he's an exceptional talent bowler as well, brilliant in the field, and he can bat. But he tends, and I agree with Fazil, he tends to be very loose at times. And I was happy to see him getting some runs, and he played as if he has been around Test cricket for quite some time. He didn't show any nervousness. He was playing short, but he needs to settle down somewhat because he's an excellent talent. And even when he was in the Jamaican setup, I used to tell him when I was a selector that he's enough and doing enough to remain in the team. And we need more than that. We need him to do more that West Jamaica can win games. Similar thing now, he needs to do a lot more than what he's doing, even though he only has three test matches. But he needs to understand he's not enough to just do enough to stay in the team. He needs to help West Indies to win test matches and so on. With that, he needs a little more responsible, a little more tighter. And once he gets the knack of that and understands that this is the national test cricket, then I'm expecting him that, you know, he'll start produce some better and more consistent performance.
Wayne Lewis in Jamaica, Fazir Muhammad in Trinidad and Tobago. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on Mason and Guest. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. Before we go to the break, John Campbell, the three matches he played, batted six times, not at once, 176 runs, best of 47, averaging 35.20. Mason and Guest is brought to you in association with the very good friends at Barbados Lottery, Bolton, Houston.
looks. He looks really
relaxed and upbeat. A guy with a lot of good vibes, as the Jamaicans would say, and his batting was enterprising. He played some good shots, but yes, shot selection and knowing which ball to leave, that's important. That's something the whole team has to definitely work on.
And Doc, just before, just to relate on Campbell, watching him over the series, he would have really impressed me, and I like the positive approach, as Mr. Man would have said. I actually think, having watched him in a few months' time, if Chris Gayle is after this series, maybe if he's finished with the ODI setup, I think John Campbell can be a possible contender to replace him and complement someone like Evan Lewis, who's on more aggressive side. Campbell will be that one to try and bat through the innings, who has a very good technique, as he's shown in the series so far.
Now, gentlemen, let's spend some time on Shea Hope. You got some concerns, Doc? Shea Hope?
Yeah, well we would have some concerns. Shea is a very talented and dedicated cricketer, but his returns thus far haven't really reflected the talent that Shea has. In the three matches, 119 runs, averaging 23. You can see the disappointment as he left the field for the final time this series. Promised a lot when he started here in Barbados with the 57. He looked really good. Yeah. But, you know, as time went on, it was just that one shot that got him out. And, you know, a lot of catches behind the wicket. In this match, you know, he drove at one that was wide.
Not a ball there to be
Yeah, right. and got caught in the gully. And today, you know, it just didn't work out today. Returns of 28 after, you know, a career
right.
that has stretched 29 tests. It right. isn't, I know we expect more from Shea. I think Shea has to sit, you know, have to go back and reflect on where he's going wrong in the longer version. I know he's had a really good ODI record of late. I don't know if it's the more aggressive approach of the ODI that has really benefited him, or if it's just that the field placing and the more rigorous character of test cricket is what's showing him up where people can really
not
work
to cut you, Doc.
But you know, I'm sure that he'll keep working at it.
Just a quick stat, Mr. Mason. Since January 1st in test cricket, I did some research. In 21 games, Shea Hope has the second lowest average of the top six of 21.38. So he's really been struggling since
21.38. Yeah. Oh, there. Interesting. Okay. Okay. Time is tight. Let's go to Antigua and speak to Sir Andy Roberts. And we're going to go to Trinidad and Tobago and speak to Philo Wallace. What a combination. Wallace and Sir Andy in the house. Gentlemen, how are you this evening?
Good evening, Andrew.
Sir Andy, how is good old Antigua?
Oh, the same as when you left it last. Okay.
Nothing has changed. And Phil, are you jogging around the Queen's Park Oval?
No, not at this time. I did
have
a morning jog. I'm not a night jogger at all.
Indeed.
I do everything in the morning.
Gentlemen, let's do an assessment of the West Indies. The three test matches. The West Indies losing the last test match, but overall they're 1-1. Let's start with you, Sir Andy. Were you expecting this result?
Well, if you follow cricket closely, you will always find that the team that's going into the final test with a series victory always, majority of the time, loses that test match because, you know, they were on a high, and I think, you know, it will take a lot, you know, to keep them at that level.
Indeed.
But all in all, I think that they surprised a lot of us.
Indeed.
The way they played in the first test match. Test matches, and I saw that Timo Roach bowled outstandingly in the first two test matches.
Philo, your assessment?
Well, Andrew, obviously, the series win by Windies over England would have surprised me, obviously, because we all have played in the previous two test series away from home.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you thought that England coming to the region would have obviously beaten the Windies, but Windies found vigour and obviously they found what is required, the formula for what is required for winning test matches in Barbados and Antigua convincingly. And I thought that those two victories pushed the English way back. I thought the English started that series badly as well, would complain a lot. They're the first English that come to the Caribbean have complained so much.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that and their selection was bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they got it wrong in the first two test matches. Obviously they got it right in the third test match and won that third test match quite convincingly. But I think Windies can take a lot from this series and obviously look to move forward and taking the cricket and rejuvenate the spectators as well. Roach obviously was outstanding. Nobody can debate that. But take 18 wickets in a three-test match series and both the way he is bowled.
Brilliant.
It's fantastic. But he was supported by Jason Holder, Azhari Joseph particularly, and Shannon Gabriel. And I want to mention Azhari Joseph because I think he's getting better. He's a work in progress. He's getting better. And I think he's going to serve Windies cricket very well in the future.
Sandy, where did England go wrong?
Well, I think the England went wrong before they arrived in the Caribbean because I thought they came with on a high, believing that they would have just turned up and beat West Indies. And it showed in the lack of preparation when they came. They didn't up for at least 2 4-day games. They just decided, look, we're going to need two-day warm-up games, and, these guys are going to crumble. And I think England also did not bowl well, especially in Antigua.
Okay.
They didn't bowl well in Antigua. I thought the length was a bit too short.
Mm-hmm.
If you check the amount of balls that was leave alone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. In Antigua.
On a pitch that is two pace, a ball flying off of a length, one would think that they would have kept the ball up a bit more, but. They started to retaliate because, they struggled and they got a lot of short ball early up against Shannon Gable especially. And they, in turn, started to bowl short.
Phil, where did England go wrong?
I think the selection for the first test match was wrong. And when you look at it, you need deck bowlers in the region.
Right.
And if you follow the commentary today or the game to this test match, Jimmy Anderson yesterday, he went in the nets with bowling coach Chris Silverwood because he realized that John Campbell was hitting him back over his head too easy because he didn't hit, was not hitting the deck. And that is what was lacking. The deck bowler or the deck bowlers in England, as we saw, Ben Stoke, Mark Wood, and Stuart Broad, they were quite effective. Anderson came into his own, but you have to hit the deck. And not picking Broad in that first test match would have pushed them way back because they came to the Caribbean with three spinners. England never came to the Caribbean with three spinners before. So obviously they underestimated our surfaces. They didn't follow the series against Sri Lanka and Bangladesh last year here in the region. They realized that the pitches can get spicy during the test series. And they obviously misread the pitches. And there was no turning back when they were shuffled for 77 and they started test match so convincingly to Windies. They could not rebound. And Antigua, obviously, as Andy said, a pitch that was up and down, they still got it wrong with their bowling line and length. And we got it right. And that is where we obviously capitalized and beat them. And it's good for us that we won those two test matches convincingly. We won. We read the conditions well, and we used them to our greatest effect.
I see. So, Andy, let's go back to the Antigua pitch, under the microscope. Was it good in your view, Andy?
It was good for cricket because we scored 300 on it. So I can't see how they complain when one team gets 300 in basically the only innings that they batted, and they were shot out for 180 odd.
But it's under the scrutiny of the ICC. The merit point loss.
But let me ask a question. When we played at Boston, the last time in England, we got shot out in 2 days.
Was it because of the pitch, though, Sandy?
Well, that's what I want to know. Every time you end score, you blame the pitch.
Indeed.
Yeah, they did that to us.
Sandy, are you defending a pitch that was below par, Sandy?
Wait.
Is it because it was in Antigua?
Talk to me. Yes, listen.
Yes.
1976, we played on a pitch at Old Trafford.
Yes.
Where we scored 211, I think, or 214 in the first innings and shot them out for 71.
Right.
And then we went back to bat and scored over 400 and then shot them out for 111 or something like that. But no one complained about the pitch. All they did, they complained that we bowled too short.
Oh, I see.
So every time that they struggle, they have excuse for why they lose.
I see.
And I am not, West Indies batted on the same pitch.
They did it and made over 300.
Made over 300. But they couldn't catch a fly.
Mm-hmm.
Not even, never mind a cold.
Mm.
And that is their problem. The problem wasn't the pitch. The problem was the old cricket.
I see. No.
Which was poor in the first two test matches.
A couple of things, Sandy. People said that Antiguans boycotted because Cornwall wasn't the side. Is that true?
Did they boycott in St. Lucia?
No.
Okay.
But Sandy, I'm dealing with Antigua though, and don't carry me to St. Lucia.
West Indians haven't been watching cricket for a long time. But the local support wasn't what it should be.
Right. Okay.
And the reason for that was because of the way we have been playing cricket
right.
over the last few years.
So Sandy, there was no boycott then. In relation to Cornwall.
He remained in England.
Oh, wonderful indeed. Well, gentlemen, time is very tight with us this evening. But Flo, is there any light at the end of the tunnel now?
Well, Andrew, when you look at one victory for Windies and retaining that Wisdom Trophy,
right.
there is light at the end of the tunnel. There's
right.
still some dark sections in that tunnel,
right.
particularly our batting, huh? I'm not convinced at all with Dan Bravo. She mm-hmm. still tickles my ball head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why he can't excel at test match level like he did in a couple of years ago when he got the 200s. And these are areas that are concerned to me, obviously. But Windies will feel proud. And Pybus and his team have some work to do still.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, there is light at the end of the tunnel. We face the Indians next, which will be a tougher assignment
mm-hmm.
than the English. So obviously, they have to get all their boxes ticked. Before the Indians arrive.
Now, Sir Andy, any technical deficiencies as far as young Shea Hope is concerned, in your view?
Well, it's not only Shea Hope, and you're stressing on Shea Hope because he hasn't scored. But if you look at all the batsmen, Craig Gathwaite has a technical problem. Campbell is his first series, and you have to look at him more closely. Ralston Chase has a big problem just as Shea Hope has. You know, it's too early. Even if you take this victory into account, it's way too early, you know, to start saying that we're approaching the corner.
Right.
We have to look at it, see where we went wrong, because we made a lot of mistakes in this series also.
Right.
And we played against a team that, you know, the first two test matches were nowhere near their best. And it shows that, you know, if you bat and bat long, I wouldn't be too hard on Darren Bravo because he tried here in Antigua. The innings of 50-odd that he played, the length of time that he stayed at the wicket, also gave us some hope that he can stick around. Although the ball was up and down, he took his lashes. And like most of the batsmen, the English batsmen were backing away. And then again, when we went to St. Lucia, a lot of our batsmen were backing away also. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Sandy Roberts and Philo Wallace are an awesome combination. Gentlemen, we want to thank you for coming through and talking to us. I'm missing the guests and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Sandy? All the best to you as well.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Wonderful indeed. And we've had a chance to look at the ODI squad. Any surprises to you, Nikhil?
I'm very glad to see Nicholas Puran in that squad. I think he's a young development player. We've seen in the T20s. He's impressed all across the world, even got an IPL contract. I think he can be one for the future, as well as O'Shane Thomas, who I think is ready with raw pace. We've seen Mark Wood with raw pace. And I think Carlos Brathwaite should be given some consideration with the injury of Kumo Paul, Mr. Mason, as a replacement.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Just before you come in, Doc, let's go and talk to Hartley Reid, because only today I was speaking to young Shaquana Clinton, and this young lady is struggling. She's in England. Of course, she would have played for the captain of the Barbados side, would have played for the West Indies as well. She's in Canada. She picked up an injury about 2 years ago. And she's in Canada. And Hartley Reid, who is a former director of the Barbados Cricket Association and, of course, a former manager of the women's side, is going to join me for the last couple of minutes on the show. Hartley, good evening to you.
Good evening, Andrew.
Good. What is the story with this young Saquon Quinton?
Well, first, let me correct you. I was the chairman of the Women's Cricket, not the manager.
Okay, chairman. Okay,
but,
fine.
But Saquon was injured in March 2017 while in training, preparing for a series when she was in Antigua.
Right.
And the attention was not the best. She was injured in April. She only started getting treatment in July.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in issues ever since. And then while the Cricket West Indies would have paid for her to go to Canada last year, April,
mm-hmm.
she went and had an operation in April. With the understanding that she would return in 3 months after, that's in July 2018, to continue that work.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cricket West Indies did not send her, so she had to pay her own way to go back to Canada for a further operation. So right now she is still in Canada on her own money.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get herself better.
Mm-hmm.
So she's having an uphill, some serious challenges in recuperating and getting better.
Mm-hmm. And I think she's had about 4 operations or so?
She had actually had 4 surgeries on the right knee.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility that she has lost her PCL and trying to see what can be done to assist her to get her. The prognosis of her actually playing cricket again looks very, very, very weak. But they're just trying to see what can happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hardy, what about the BCA? I mean, the BCA, shouldn't they be involved in this as well? Or are they involved?
Well, BCA has actually won 6 of the Cricket West Indies because of the territory.
Right.
But nothing was, very little was done by the BCA to actually understand. To assist her, and you are talking about she was the captain of the CA team and the only successful captain that they actually had, both on the 19 level and the senior.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason for the lag time between her injury and the actual treatment? Was it a problem with identifying it? Was it a monetary problem?
No, but having gotten the injury in April, she came back to Barbados, and they had some issues with getting some medical action on her. So it was only Dalton Smith, who was then acting president of Cricket of Bambi, the BCA.
Mm-hmm.
He had a conversation with Dr. Bennett when the Cricket West Indies met here in Barbados for a meeting in 2017 for her to get the 2017 for her to get some started that treatment, and then it was from there that we were trying to get her recovered.
Well, it's a bit puzzling because our level of medical care isn't that bad here, if I may say so myself, and you know, there are ways and means of having care, you know, as you know, for free through your clinic. So she would have gone to the appropriate doctor. But I mean that you can have your needs met by the private sector or the public sector. So I am.
But you are talking about a
Cricket West Indies.
Any action, and that way would have had to be initiated by Cricket West Indies.
Well, I guess that would have been nice, but you know.
So whose responsibility is this, though, Hartley? I mean, is it the Cricket West Indies or the BCL or accommodation? She needs help.
Ultimately, it's Cricket West Indies because she represented successfully the Cricket West Indies at the World Cup,
right?
And she was under contract at the time.
But her injury was during cricket duties.
Right.
Yes, she was in Antigua
preparing for the World Cup.
In a cricket practice game.
Okay.
And what stage of her progress is she at right now in terms of the injury?
can't see her. She's in Canada.
She's in Canada. I spoke to her today.
By herself.
Right. She's not happy about that. So I could almost feel the tears in her eyes if you can do that. And when I spoke to her today, and I'm appealing to those responsible to look after the young lady. Doc, it's a PCL tear. Do you know what it is, Doc?
Must be the posterior cruciate ligament.
Only must be
the orthopedic procedure. I mean, I still believe, even though that may be a more difficult injury to repair, that there should be enough expertise here to start to approach that.
Right.
And these are tears that players in the NFL and other sports teams would have. So I think probably the best individuals for those type of injuries would probably be in the U.S.
Hartley, before you go, what is your recommendation to solve this problem? That's a reasonable question.
That's out of my realm. I'm not a doctor. I can't.
As a former chairman of selectors for the women.
I would have loved.
And a former BCA director as well.
Anything I say now is a waste of time. This is 2 years that have elapsed while it has happened to Shapana. So there isn't anything. I cannot even begin to think what suggestion I can offer to get her knee repaired. The doctors will have to get on to that one.
Right, indeed. Well, Hartley, I want to thank you very much indeed for coming through and talking to us. And before you go, I'm sure you heard that young Hayden Walsh has left the franchise in Barbados. He's not happy about not being selected. And, of course, some of the matters, he's gone back to Antigua. Have you heard that as well? Hidden Walsh?
Well, I was at cricket when the news broke that Hayden Walsh had left the Barbados Pride and returned home. But that's the Barbados Cricket Association, and the Barbados Pride would have to make an official statement on that front. I'm just an ordinary spectator and I'll watch and enjoy my cricket.
Well, you can confirm that Hayden Walsh left the franchise and has gone back to Antigua.
Oh, yes, he has returned home.
You're very economical with your words there, Hartley.
As I said, I am no longer... In fact, you started by stating that I am no longer a member of the board.
That is true.
So I cannot speak on behalf of
the... Beautiful. Thanks, Hartley, for coming through and talking to us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And thanks for helping me.
Right. Former sergeant there in the...
We need some help for her.
I think we do. We do definitely need some help for her. And I hope that those responsible listening, the Barbados Cricket Association, Cricket West Indies, you must come together and help this wonderful young lady. We hope you enjoyed our program half as much as we enjoyed presenting to you. Andrew Mason, on behalf of the team, saying good evening and goodbye.